From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
This case is not about immigration. It is about the rule of law.
The U.S. attorney from Massachusetts charges a state judge and a former court officer with obstruction of justice.
Nobody's above the law.
We get analysis in our Week in Review. Also today, a new young author who uses short stories to tackle big issues.
People asking me, why do you write these political stories? Like, what's it about politics? And I'm sort of at the point where I'm just like, you know, what would you have me write instead? If the house is on fire, I'm not going to talk about what's in the fridge.
And a state senator on his role as a political consultant for HBO's Veep.
There is no I in freedom. Freedom is not me-dom. It's we-dom.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday and time for our Week in Review, beginning with federal charges of obstruction of justice against a state judge and court officer. Prosecutors yesterday said Judge Shelley Richmond Joseph and now retired court officer Wesley McGregor obstructed justice when they allegedly helped a man slip out the back door of a courthouse to avoid detention by U.S. immigration authorities. Here's U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling.
This case is not about immigration. It is about the rule of law. The allegations involve the intentional interference with federal officers in the course of their duties. That is a crime.
Yet Matthew Siegel of the Massachusetts ACLU says this is not a criminal matter.
If the federal government has an issue with how a judge is behaving, they can pick up the phone and try to talk about it.
Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner goes even further.
There could have been an injunction. There could have been a civil proceeding. Judges are rule followers. To use the criminal process this way is like using a thermonuclear device to kill a gnat.
But at his news conference yesterday, U.S. Attorney Lelling said his critics are wrong.
We did not bring this case in response to the public debate over immigration enforcement. There are reasonable arguments on both sides of that debate, but this isn't a policy seminar. It's a law enforcement action.
The judge, Shelley Richmond Joseph has been suspended without pay. Judge Joseph and former court officer Wesley McGregor are now both out on bail. And here to help us make sense of the case is Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Also with us this week is Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hey there, Michael.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Let me just get your guys' initial reaction to this case. It's one that we've covered on the program before, but really went to the next level yesterday with these charges of obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, what do you think about it?
Well, it's somewhat unusual, but I don't think that it's unwarranted. I think that let's suppose you had a state court judge in Texas who had a person in their courtroom for some, you know, crime or misdemeanor, felony, whatever it may be. And there was an ATF agent that was coming to arrest that person on a gun violation. And this particular state court judge, hypothetically, you know, doesn't believe somebody should be arrested for a gun violation because this is Texas, and decides to scurry the guy out the back door. I mean, people would be appalled by that, and people would regard that as obstruction of justice and would expect the federal government to do something about that. If that hypothetical state court judge had thwarted a federal officer from arresting someone on a gun charge. So I agree with U.S. Attorney Lelling that we have to look at this not as an immigration issue, but as a rule of law issue.
Interesting. So we've heard the Democratic Attorney General in our state, Maura Healey, say that Andrew Lelling, a Republican appointee, is acting with a political motive. And you're suggesting maybe the inverse is true.
Well, actually, there's a reason for that. I have sources that tell me that Attorney General Healey is preparing a lawsuit, actually, to sue the administration to prevent the state from having to cooperate with the federal authorities in terms of immigration and illegal aliens. So frankly, she's the one being political. She's just mad that this issue, that by charging this judge, it makes her lawsuit, which she hasn't yet announced, look like it's reactive. So she's actually upset, in my view, for political reasons, according to my sources.
Interesting. So WBUR's newsroom, I'll just note, hasn't independently confirmed that report, but Jennifer Braceras may be breaking some news on our air. Michael Curry, how about you? What do you make of these charges?
Well, I mean, it's actually another concern that many of us have that this president and this administration and its anti-immigrant policies is having a chilling effect and anti-access effect across systems. So healthcare, we know that people aren't going to get healthcare because they're concerned about ICE investigators and they're not getting appointments. Now we add on top of that that people aren't accessing our state judicial systems potentially because now there's a concern that state government will be working with the federal government. I think ultimately I'm spot on with Mara Healey, Attorney General Mara Healey, that there has to be a separation here. There has to be a respect, a mutual respect between federal authorities and our state courts. And that didn't happen here. I think that there is a taint of politics in this. Having worked closely with our U.S. Attorney's Office in the past, and I've done that in my NAACP role, there is a mandate that comes down from D.C. on what kind of investigations and what kind of cases. There is definitely an anti-immigrant mandate coming from the Trump administration, and it's unfortunate that this U.S. attorney chose this case to make as an example.
I will tell you that this prosecution in no way involved the Federal Department of Justice. They were not aware that the U.S. Attorney's Office was looking into it. This has actually been pending for a long time, almost a year, ever since it happened. The grand jury was investigating it. So this was not a rash, reactive charge. It's something they've been deliberating about on their own without the long arm of Washington telling them what to do. And this is where they came out, that this needed to be done to uphold the rule of law. But let's just take another hypothetical we can sort of take it outside of the realm of immigration.
Can we do that in just one moment? I just want to add, I think, though, that the cooperation that Michael was talking about was the ICE officer who was in the courtroom, right? And that's the chilling effect
Correct.
You're worried about is what that cooperation could be, that you have a state court and a federal official there to pick him up. Go ahead, Jennifer. Sorry.
Well, state court judges cannot close the courtroom to federal officials. That in and of itself is against the law. Forget about scurrying the guy out the back door. But the hypothetical I was going to mention is, let's go back to the time of segregation. You had a lot of racist and intransient state court judges in the South. And what if the state court judges in the South just decided that they weren't going to, you know, apply the rule of law or weren't going to abide by what, you know, the federal marshals said they had to do? That would have been absurd. And so, yes, we do have a federal system where state and federal governments have separate jurisdictions over things, but that doesn't mean that state jurisdictions can just go tell the federal government to pound sand. They still have to abide by federal law.
I'm not sure I get the equivalence in that. I think the concern here is the anti-immigrant rhetoric from this administration, and whether it was a direct from the Department of Justice or just this U.S. attorney trying to feed or satisfy this administration with a prosecution. I think you've heard from many experts here, even at the station, that this was just a disrespect to state courts. This could have been handled in a non-criminal way and should have been handled that way.
So do you think a state court official would have been within their bounds to flout Brown versus Board of Education and flout the orders of a U.S. Marshal in desegregating a school? What's the difference?
I think clearly here the issue is that the judge in this case felt like the intervention of the federal immigration authorities in this case was unwarranted and chose an action that many could argue, and I think is a valid argument.
It's not her job to decide if immigration policy is unwarranted.
You can argue whether it was appropriately mishandled, but there's a discretion that the U.S. attorney has in all of these cases. And I think we've debated that even on these shows. That discretion can be abused, and I think this U.S. attorney abused that discretion in this case.
Well, let me just interject one additional factor that I think is a complicating one in this case, which is the original reason that this undocumented immigrant was picked up in the first place, as we understand it, was that Newton police ran his license plate through their database and saw that he was wanted for a DUI in another state. But when he came before the court, Judge Joseph determined that the mugshot didn't actually match the man before her in court. And so she apparently had some concern about whether he had been arrested on false pretenses in the first place and that therefore it would be unfair for ICE to be able to catch him. And when we talked to former federal judge Nancy Gertner about this yesterday, she said, you know, maybe Judge Joseph could have handled things better. She recalled the similar case of mistaken identity in her court where she just kind of froze the proceedings until it could be determined clearly whether this was the right person in front of her. But what about that argument, Jennifer Braceras?
This judge deliberately went off the record in order to hide what she was doing.
Right. She shut off the courtroom recording for roughly a minute, which is against protocol.
Right.
Although typically judges aren't indicted for that, though, right?
No, of course not. But then she went and lied to all of her senior colleagues about what she had done. I mean, the intent, in my view, was clear. She was subverting federal law and she intended to hide it. I just think because she is a judge, it's actually worse what she did than if, for example, you know, a private citizen were to harbor an illegal immigrant or a church official, for example. She is an officer of the court. Her job is to uphold the rule of law. That applies whether she agrees with the law, whether she thinks the law is fair, whether she thinks the law is unfair. There are a lot of federal laws that may not be fair. There are some people who believe strict federal restrictions on gun ownership are unfair. But would that give, in my hypothetical, you know, a Texas state court judge the right to scurry someone out the back door and avoid capture by the ATF? Absolutely not.
I just point out, we did hear from Governor Charlie Baker on this matter this week as well. He was talking with Channel 7. And I'll just point out, too, that he's not someone who has always agreed with the president, even though he is a Republican. But he does sound a little bit more like he's toeing the line on this one.
Nobody's above the law. And in this particular case, there are issues that were raised that deserve to be investigated. And I believe at the end of the day, this will be decided by the federal courts.
So what about that, Michael Curry? I mean, I think even a lot of Democrats in the state would say, you know, they've generally found Charlie Baker to be a very, you know, sober-minded, clear thinker on issues like this. And yet he seems to think that Andrew Lelling has a case here.
Yeah, I don't think I'm surprised by Governor Baker's position. I think he would. This is a predictable position for him. I think the challenge, though, and if I were speaking to the governor, is when do you use a criminal process to go after a state court judge using their discretion? There's a lot of discretion in our judicial system. And ultimately, you can question whether she used the best discretion. I think it's a valid argument. But I don't think a criminal prosecution was warranted. And it's a disrespect for our state judicial system, our state court system, to have brought a case against this judge and that court officer.
So the discretion point is an interesting one. But because we don't know what went on behind the scenes, I think it's unfair to speculate. And what we do know is that this investigation has been going on for almost a year. We don't know. We do know that the U.S. attorney was in touch with her lawyer. And so we don't know what they had been negotiating during that time, what may have been offered to her to resolve it differently. We have no idea. So I think it's unfair to speculate and to act as though this was an unfair use of discretion, because it may be that there were other options on the table. And for whatever reason, things didn't go the judge's way. We don't have that information. And until we do, I think it's unfair to say that the U.S. attorney used his discretion unfairly.
In the scheme of everything that we need our U.S. attorney to focus on, this is not one of those.
We're rounding up the week in news with Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum, and Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. And while I have you both, I do want to get to another topic for the week, which is the ever-growing 2020 field of presidential candidates. We're up to 20 Democrats in the race right now that we can officially include former Vice President Joe Biden, who has immediately looked beyond the primary and take an aim at the president.
If we give Donald Trump 8 years in the White House, he will forever and fundamentally alter the character of this nation, who we are. And I cannot stand by and watch that happen.
Also this week, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton tossed his hat into the ring. And on WBUR's Morning Edition, he said he's not worried about his high-profile failed effort to oust Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. In fact, he says he's proud to not be an establishment candidate.
That's not what people want, especially in the districts that we have to win to defeat Trump. It'll make me a stronger nominee that I've proven that I'm willing to take on the Washington establishment.
You buy that, Jennifer Braceras? What do you think about Seth Moulton? Does he have a shot here? Is he just the man to take on the president?
So he absolutely would have a shot in the general. The question is whether he gets through this very large and turbulent primary. He's a relative unknown. But I do think that if the Democrats want to win in 2020, they would be wise to look very, very carefully at Seth Moulton. He is positive. He is a patriot. Four tours of duty in Iraq. He has wide crossover appeal. The fact that he challenged Nancy Pelosi is a plus to independent voters and even to, you know, young progressive voters who feel that maybe their concerns aren't being heard by the establishment. None of those are negative things. His challenge will be name recognition in the primary and just getting through the minefield that, you know, the next 12, 24 months, whatever it is. I don't know how many months it is.
A long time still.
Right. The minefield that awaits.
And, you know, there is some question, though, about how just crowded this field is and how it is hard to stand out. You know, when we at WBUR spoke with the Democratic political consultant Scott Fersen, who worked on Moulton's first campaign for Congress, even Fersen said, you know, the lane that Moulton would be running in is already getting crowded.
When Seth shows up for the presidential race, he's going to find that Pete Buttigieg is standing in his lane. Buttigieg is a veteran. He's got some good policy chops, very, very smart, same kind of pedigree from a better part of the country, I think, for Democrats. And frankly, he's generated a ton of excitement.
Buttigieg, of course, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, so more of a swing state than what we have out here. Yeah. And so how about that, Michael Curry? I mean, does Scott Fersen have a point there?
Yeah, I think he does. I think, quite frankly, 20 candidates is a lot of candidates to run. But as a Democrat, I'm excited that there's a large field with diverse perspectives. I think there'll be a little bit of tripping over each other's shoes to figure out who is the ideal candidate. I think people want a stark difference from the president we have. They want them to be tough, someone who can come back with the quips and the retorts to this president, but at the same time have a vision for the future. I don't know if Moulton is, at least in my conversation with other Democrats, is one that people are paying much attention to. And quite frankly, I think he has some work to do, not just to differentiate himself, but to make a case for why he should be the candidate. It is an uphill climb for him.
All right, let's talk about Biden a little bit. He is the latest entry to the race. He officially got in yesterday. And for whatever polls are worth at this stage, Morning Consult and Politico give him an 8-point edge in their latest survey if he were head-to-head against President Trump, although that doesn't necessarily mean he can get out of the primary. But he also is facing controversy right away for not directly apologizing to Anita Hill for the way he handled the 1991 Clarence Thomas hearings. His campaign disclosed earlier this week that he did call Hill and express his, quote, regret for what she endured. Hill, who is now a professor at Brandeis, then told the New York Times that she was unsatisfied with that call, didn't think he maybe took full responsibility. And Biden sort of answered some of these questions in his first interview on television today. Here he is talking with Joy Behar on ABC's The View.
You know, I think what she wants you to say is, I'm sorry for the way I treated you, not for the way you were treated. I think that might be closer.
Well, but I'm sorry the way she got treated. In terms of, I never heard say, if you go back and look what I said and didn't say, I don't think I treated her badly.
So how about that, Jennifer? I mean, he's choosing his words carefully there. He's saying, I'm sorry this happened to you. He's not saying, I'm sorry for what I did.
I guess you'd have to tell me specifically what it is you think Biden did to Anita Hill that was so offensive. He was on the side that was opposed to Clarence Thomas. So what exactly was the problem?
Well, the argument would be that he was in charge of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, I get the argument.
And that he didn't call corroborating witnesses.
Right.
So that would be, that. In theory, that's what he ought to apologize for. That's what his critics
say. Yeah, I don't think that, I don't want to get into Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. I have strong views about that. And I certainly don't think that as a member of the party that was dragging Clarence Thomas's name through the mud, that Joe Biden has anything to apologize to Anita Hill for. I'd like to see him apologize to Clarence Thomas, actually, but that's a whole other story. As a political analyst, I would simply say that I don't think that most of today's younger voters remember that, care about it. Joe Biden has other issues with the younger electorate than that. But he does have the name recognition, and he does have a lot of positives that could help him in a general election. And so we'll see what happens. But I don't think that's a big issue for him, no.
I'm reminded, though, that Clarence Thomas, during those hearings, Michael Curry, referred to that confirmation hearing as a circus and as a lynching.
Right. A high-tech lynching.
Yeah, and as Biden takes criticism for not being sensitive enough to Anita Hill in some people's estimation, he might counter that he was trying to be sensitive to Thomas because there's a long history of sham justice for black men in this country. So do you cut any slack to Biden?
No, I mean, I was offended even with the reference to a high-tech lynching. I think that this was really Biden's failure, and I think he's increasingly starting to acknowledge that as a person who had some sway in the process of the hearing. There should have been corroborating witnesses called, and I think he does owe an apology directly to Anita Hill for his part in that hearing. Ultimately, you can oppose the candidate, and at that time, Clarence Thomas, but still have flaws in how the hearing was dealt. We know that we would not deal with a woman today like we did then. We know that a congressional hearing would not take place the same way, and we've just gone through that.
With Kavanaugh.
With Kavanaugh. So the reality is I think Biden's in a situation where he can fight this and really hurt his campaign, or in a heightened awareness, because I disagree with Jennifer. There is that young generation I talk to and train in my classes and in other settings. They're becoming students of history. So they're actually looking back at these cases and saying, what kind of a person were you when you were in these other roles? And do you deserve my vote? He'll have to answer to them.
As we were coming on the air today, Biden's campaign was touting his $6.3 million fundraising total in the first 24 hours. That surpasses Beto O'Rourke and Bernie Sanders, who had previously had the high. So it doesn't seem to be hurting him, at least by that measure. I do want to point out, too, that at a rally in Iowa yesterday, another one of our presidential candidates, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, went after Joe Biden. But on a different front, she attacked his work in the past on bankruptcy laws.
At a time when the biggest financial institutions in this country were trying to put the squeeze on millions of hardworking families, there was nobody to stand up for them. I got in that fight because they just didn't have anyone. And Joe Biden was on the side of the credit card companies.
So what do you think, Jennifer Braceras? Is that a more effective, make it a more of a policy critique than going after, any of his personal characteristics?
That may be, in a Democratic primary, a more effective approach, since primaries are usually fought on policy and ideology, and they draw the most ideological voters. But I try to look at this as a political analyst, and I try to take myself out of, my partisan role and say, which of these candidates has the best chance in a general election of winning independent voters in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, West Virginia, the states Hillary lost to Donald Trump? And the answer is Joe Biden has a better chance than Elizabeth Warren in those states. I also believe that Seth Moulton would have a good chance in those states. But a lot of voters, as Bill Clinton used to say, Democrats want to fall in love with their candidates, right? And they want ideological purity. But ideological purity means nothing if you can't win. And from a political perspective, I don't think Elizabeth Warren has a chance.
Last word to you, Michael Curry. She's running a very policy-heavy campaign right from the get-go. Is that the winning strategy?
Yeah, I think Democrats want something bold. They want a candidate that's bringing a bold vision, is willing to talk about free public education on the college level, that's willing to talking about going after for-profit college institutions, at least not giving them the financial boost, the subsidies that they may get. There is a need to have bold vision, and I think Senator Warren has always delivered that. I'm not convinced that we know now who could win. If we didn't learn anything else from Donald Trump, is that all the pundits were wrong. That, quite frankly, if you get a candidate that's willing to challenge the authority.
I called that one in February of 2016.
You were one of the few.
There's evidence to prove it.
And I think that the same thing could happen on the Democratic side. I think Senator Warren, her message is strong. It's sharp. And people know she cares. I think that authenticity that she brings to this debate is going to be refreshing.
Authenticity with her light beer on New Year's Eve? That wasn't perceived as very authentic.
Well, I'm very fortunate to know her well. And on healthcare issues and many other issues, she's an authentic person who I'm excited is in the race.
That's Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Braceras, political consultant and senior fellow for legal policy with the Independent Women's Forum. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we remember Celtics legend John Havlicek. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The city has lost a legend. Celtics Hall of Famer John Havlicek died yesterday at age 79. Even those of us without memories of his 16-year career are probably familiar with one immortal moment, the clutch play that sealed a playoff victory in 1965. Here's Johnny Most with one of the best-known calls in American sports.
Greer is putting the ball on a play. He gets it out deep, and Havlicek steals it!
The Celtics, of course, went on to win the NBA championship that season, one of eight titles during Havlicek's career. WBUR and NPR sports commentator Bill Littlefield was a teen back then. He joins us now to talk about the Celtics' all-time leading scorer. Hey there, Bill.
Hey.
So that Johnny Most call definitely comes to mind when people think about John Havlicek. How do you remember him?
Well, it was memorable for a couple of reasons. Obviously, Havlicek stole the ball at the absolute most opportune moment in 1965. But the other thing was Johnny Most is the easiest play-by-play guy in the world to imitate. And so everywhere you went, you heard people doing their gravelly-voiced Johnny Most imitation for a long time
for
after
sure.
the play.
You know, one of the things, too, that I'm mindful of is that, you know, we had Bob Ryan, the Boston Globe columnist, on our air this morning talking about how fondly he remembers John Havlicek off the court as well. What a big-hearted gentleman he was.
Well, that's one of the most extraordinary things in terms of what you can find everywhere today. People who are celebrating John Havlicek's life almost hurry to get through talking about what a wonderful and complete and energized basketball player he was so that they can have time to tell you about what a great guy he was. He impressed an awful lot of people as a terrific fellow.
Yeah, the numbers are impressive, right? The 16 seasons we mentioned, he was an All-Star 13 of those years. He's still the team's highest
scorer. More to the point, from Havlicek's point of view, contributed to teams that won eight championships.
One of the consummate team players of that era.
Absolutely, right.
And we're slowly losing them. WBUR and NPR sports commentator Bill Littlefield, thank you so much, as always, for your memories and your insight.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
HBO's hit series Veep satirizes American politics. And in the show's seventh and final season, Selina Meyer, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is running, again, for president.
I'm not sure about this part where I say I want to be president for all Americans. I mean, do I? You know, mm-hmm. all of them?
How about real Americans?
Oh, yeah, that's good. And okay. then we can figure out what I mean later.
The former Seinfeld star might be the biggest name in the Veep credits, but there's a local name, too, Massachusetts State Senator Eric Lesser. Lesser is a political consultant on the program, so we asked him what the job entails and how he landed it.
Yeah, so it's a fun story. So I had worked for President Obama for 4 years. I worked on his campaign in 2007 and 2008, and then I worked for him in the White House for 2 years. For a large portion of that period, I was the assistant to David Axelrod. So I had a small cubbyhole in the West Wing right next to the Oval Office and was there for the first 2 years of the administration. But I came back to Massachusetts, and I was actually getting ready to enroll in law school, and my phone rang. It was a friend of mine who had done a lot of work. Her name is Tammy Naomi Haddad, a great, great figure in Washington and someone who's involved in a lot of stuff. She was involved in helping put together a new show for HBO called Veep. And the creators of the show are actually British. Armando Iannucci is the name of the creator. And he had done In the Thick of It and In the Loop that poked fun at 10 Downing Street. They were brilliant and great writers, but of course, they're British and needed some help navigating, you know, some of the nuances of American politics. So they needed some consultants to kind of help them with the accuracy and the tone of the show and that kind of thing.
I'm curious, though. I mean, I would assume that you can draw on your experience in the White House as you guide this show. But how about your time now as a state senator? I mean, is there anything from Beacon Hill that you can take for the show?
Yeah, well, so there, you know, so the show is about Washington and it's about the presidency and the vice presidency. So I'm primarily drawing off my experience working in Washington. But no, I mean, of course, you know, it's a great human drama and a lot of elements of politics are applicable in a lot of places. So actually around the State House, it's become a bit of a joke sometimes. People come up to me and they say, hey, Lesser, is this going to show up in Veep? And the answer is, well, everyone's identity will be protected, but the situation may or may not end up in a comedy show.
Well, so how does that transfer happen then? I mean, is it you then going to the writers and saying, oh, I've got this idea for a scene? Is it that hands-on or is it more they're running things by you to see is this accurate? How does it go?
So it really depends on the sequence of where they're at in production. So, you know, generally speaking, the writing team will kind of conceptually think through what the season's going to look like at the very beginning. So at that point, it's a little bit more conceptual. You know, how will this play out? What would this storyline look like? Does it feel realistic to what your experience is? And then actually it will get very specific, when we're looking through specific scripts. You know, it can be as specific as the color of this badge is off or this acronym isn't correct or, you know, the way that this agency is referred to is not accurate.
But the budgeting for this shows that there is a real commitment to at least getting things, you know, accurate generally.
Yeah.
I know that you've disclosed on ethics filings in the past that this is a side hustle that in some years has paid between $60,000 and $100,000.
Yeah.
And there's multiple consultants, right?
So it's HBO. It's a serious production. And, you know, I think what they appreciate is that, you know, their viewers are sophisticated. And, you know, obviously it's a comedy. It's not a documentary. And so it is fiction and it's a comedy. But they want it to feel real and they want it to, you know, feel at least real enough so that people kind of feel connected to it and are excited to watch it.
All right. I want to play a little bit more sound. This is from season two when Selina Meyer, who's played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, is the Democratic vice president and she's out campaigning for the midterm elections. And you hear the midterm results coming back and they're not so great.
It's like a happy Nuremberg.
I know.
Well, where'd the Red Sea go? That lady just parted it.
Hey, POTUS needs to know about this because Meyer's on fire.
We just lost the Florida 3rd, 5th, and 6th.
Great. So much for the retired mobster vote. Florida. Gotta break it off at Jacksonville and roll it to Cuba.
There's a lot there to unpack.
There's sort of a jab at the media, too. But how do you help with a scene like that?
Yeah.
Is it the pacing? Is it the lines? What are you doing?
Yeah, it's sort of all of the above. So in that case, just to set the scene, you know, the vice president, Selina Meyer, was working very hard to try to prove her worth in the run-up to the midterms to try to get the president and her party some extra seats. Of course, it backfired. And so with that, it's actually roughly based off the experience in the 2010 midterms for the Democrats in the White House and, of course, in Congress at the time. So really what we were doing there is just working with the writers on, you know, which congressional districts would be the places where there would be a focus. What does election night in a White House look like? Feel like? Who's in the room?
Well, listen, it's good that you can turn the 2010 midterms into a joke because I'm sure when you were actually in the White House, it wasn't so funny.
No. You know, some of it is our own therapy to laugh at traumatizing experiences.
So I know you can't tell us too much about the newest season, but I do want to play a little bit of sound from this one. This is from the premiere episode. And what we can say is that Selina Meyer is running for president this time. And this scene is as she and her team learn about another candidate announcing their own campaign. Let's take a listen.
Now, we have another candidate announcing for president.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say white guy.
I was reminded of another innovator by the name of Jesus Christ. Thank you.
Two wheelchair guys behind him? What, we didn't get the point with the first one?
So the thing I love about that scene, Senator, is this sort of dripping cynicism there, right?
Yeah.
That everything that you're just staging, you want a certain demographic represented behind you, and it's all about optics. I mean, it is kind of cynical, but it also maybe a little bit of truth in there.
Of course, yeah. I mean, part of what makes it funny is there's elements of truth in any good comedy. So, you know, having some self-awareness about that and an ability to laugh about it is part of the fun.
You know, Emily Nussbaum in The New Yorker writing about the show, I thought made an interesting point. She was kind of comparing it, and this was a few years ago, which was comparing Veep to other popular political shows at the time, like House of Cards and Scandal. And she was saying that those sort of darker, more serious shows, they do reveal something about Washington, but that at least the main characters in there are able to accomplish what they're after. They may be using illegitimate means to do it. But what Veep kind of does is sort of portray the gridlock accurately, right? I mean, is it in some ways more on the nose than the dramas?
Yeah. You know, I personally am not a big House of Cards fan. I just find it too dark. You know, it's certainly well written. You know, the craft of it is great, but I just found it too dark for my tastes. I'm a huge West Wing fan. I grew up on the West Wing. One of the ways that this has been described, and I actually think Armando described this to me the first time we spoke about the show. He said, you know, West Wing is what we all hope politics is, and Veep is what we're afraid it actually is. But there's a lightheartedness to Veep that I think is important also, which is, you know, there's a lot of cynicism, but many of the characters, Amy, for example, is really just trying to do her best in a broken system. And so I think that, you know, the levity of Veep is, I think, more accurate than some of the darker shows like Scandal or House of Cards.
So in addition to you, there is another Boston connection this season on Veep. Comedian Jimmy Tingle, who ran for lieutenant governor in the last election cycle, has made a brief guest starring appearance wearing a Boston Red Sox hat, right, with the iconic B on the front. Let's take a listen to that scene.
I am sick and tired of these hoity-toity people like yourself prancing in here with this la-ti-da attitude and total disregard for the working-class people of this country like myself.
Truth to power. Good for you. Mm-hmm. My aide, Mr. Walsh, would like to speak with you.
Your aide? Yes. Your hat is so fun. The bee. Have you been to Barbuda?
Did you help with that one, Senator?
We did review that script. Yes, I also loved it because there's, of course, a Western Mass cameo there. They're in Adams, Mass. So anytime we can get Western Mass and Jimmy Tingle into an HBO show, just fantastic scene. And he did a masterful job with it.
That's State Senator Eric Lesser, who represents the 1st Hampton and Hampshire District. He's a political consultant for HBO's Veep, which is in its final season. Stay with us. Coming up, a new young author that the New York Times has called a necessary American voice. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Our next guest is a young author who is taking the literary word by storm. The New York Times calls him a new and necessary American voice and describes his book, Friday Black, as, quote, a powerful and important and strange and beautiful collection of stories. Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya will be at the Porter Square bookstore tonight, and he joins me now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're great. Very glad to have you. And your book, Friday Black, is a collection of short stories that tackle a range of social issues, racism, consumerism among them. I'm curious what it is about the short story genre that appeals to you and why you think it's an effective way to tackle those as opposed to, I don't know, a novel or poetry or something else.
Yeah, I think I really like the feeling of giving someone the tip of the iceberg, giving them just maybe a brief experience in someone's life, a day, and making us sort of feel that there's so much more we can sort of unpack. Because I think that's sort of maybe more closely mirrors what it is to like experience something briefly, hear a quick news story, and then have it be gone from us, you know? So I think that's interesting. But also I think just formally I like feeling as though every single word counts, really trying to go for that sort of concentrated sort of power.
two things that really stand out to me in your collection are graphic violence and humor. And that you somehow managed to weave those two things together. I'm thinking of the short story that sort of becomes the title of the whole collection, Friday Black, which sort of tackles this cultural phenomenon that we call Black Friday and this sort of, you know, rabid consumerism. You have these sort of graphic scenes of people stomping over each other and fighting in the mall to buy their goods and, you know, sort of sweeping bodies aside and this kind of thing. I'm wondering how you tried to weave those things together. Like, why tackle something that is such a sort of serious and dark way of commenting on a social flaw, but to do it in a humorous way somehow?
Well, you know, I'm going to quote Trevor Noah because he said something pretty smart about this. He said, I use humor as a way of reminding myself that on the opposite side of whatever obstacle I'm dealing with, I'm still me. That resonates with me. I think it's a way of calling power back to yourself, of sort of poking fun at the giant. And it's also a way to be engaging. It's a way for me to be entertained. I like my stories to be entertaining. I like them to be fun. And I don't think, you know, using humor is to be flippant about the seriousness of a problem. I think you can use humor and be dead serious, actually. And I try to, like, walk that line.
I'd say you do that a lot. There's a lot of dead serious humor in this book. There's also intense violence in the first story, I should say, in the book. It's called The Finkelstein Five. It's a fictional story that centers on the acquittal of a white man who decapitates five black children with a chainsaw. So really grim stuff here. And he somehow gets off by claiming self-defense. And as a reader, I hear echoes of the Trayvon Martin case. Your fictional defendant is named George, just like the real defendant. The Finkelstein Five makes me think of the Emanuel Five, and there's also a character named Emanuel in that story. The child victims kind of recall the 16th Street Baptist Church bombings. So I'm wondering how you hope your fiction makes people think about real life.
Yeah, I absolutely do hope the fiction sort of calls to, like, mind all the terrible sort of violence that we sort of have started to grow accustomed to, I think. It was important for me to use a chainsaw because I think that chainsaw represents a sort of grim kind of violence that is hard to ignore. But when someone is killed with a gun, you know, they're just as dead as if they're killed with a chainsaw. But it seems to me like, you know, we're almost comfortable with these sort of black unarmed people being killed by guns. And so to me, like, you know, the chainsaw, again, sort of makes it harder to sort of skip over that. But all those things you've called to mind, you know, they're in my mind. And I think in a lot of minds of people of color perpetually, because they're those sort of same sort of attitudes and, I don't know, that spirit of violence has sort of, you know, evolved and taken so many different forms and still here today. And so I hope that these stories sort of make us see that.
And it seems to me that you have this juxtaposition of something that's supposed to be on its face absurd, but that is also going to feel real somehow, right? Because the premise of this story is that the defendant, George, is able to say, oh, well, these kids were loitering outside the library instead of actually being inside the library studying like productive system citizens. And so therefore, I was well within my rights to defend myself by murdering them. And it seems it's absolutely ridiculous. And yet it seems to me that you're trying to say, you know, it can feel sometimes like, no matter how ridiculous the crime, the perpetrator would still get off.
Yeah, you know, we had an audio of Zimmerman being told directly not to engage Trayvon Martin, you know, by the actual authorities, being told not to and still going to do so and killing him and being let off. You know, that's a real thing that happened. And so I think oftentimes the criminal justice system can feel like a very bad joke, depending on your point of view. And so I tried to get some of that energy into that story.
So the Emanuel character that I mentioned is the protagonist in The Finkelstein Five. Mm-hmm. He's black, and he has a constant inner monologue about his own blackness level, as he puts it. He thinks about it being on a scale of 1 to 10 and turning it up or down. And in recent years, we've started talking about that, maybe not in a numerical term, but we've talked about the term code switching, right, which is more and more common. Should we be talking about that even more?
Yeah, I think it's important to think about code switching and, like, in different ways and like, think about how many different identities are forced to sort of shave parts of themselves off. You know, Emanuel is black, so, like, that's the primary sort of space he's negotiating against. But there's so many of us who, depending on our sort of either whether it be our race, our religion, our sexuality, our sort of understanding of gender, are forced to sort of be other than ourselves or, like, negotiate who we are in spaces.
Depending on the audience.
Depending on the audience, depending on the people who are in power in the spaces that you inhabit. And people are kind of forced to do that. And, you know, their safety is sort of in question. If they are or are not able to, their potential to earn, make a living is in question. And so, you know, I think it's important that we think about that. And also, I think it's important that we get to a place where we sort of start understanding that there are so many ways to be, you know, a good person. There's so many ways to be someone who is totally, you know, is valid and worthy of being in a space. And maybe hopefully eventually we won't have to be, everyone won't have to be so adept at, you know, moving up and down these different scales.
You know, we've also seen the idea of levels of blackness come up in the debate about Colin Kaepernick's protest against police violence. Former Patriot star Rodney Harrison declared at one point that Kaepernick is not black. Kaepernick is biracial and was adopted and raised by a white couple. And so Harrison argued that he doesn't really understand the black experience. Rodney Harrison later apologized for that. But I'm wondering how you think about identity in that way. I mean, he's talking about the way you're perceived on the outside versus your lived experience.
I think, you know, part of, you know, and part of what I hope this, my story does in like sort of answering to that question is, you know, it makes us remember that, you know, blackness is not monolith. Blackness is so many different things. There is no like specific and singular experience of blackness. And, you know, Colin Kaepernick absolutely is black. Maybe he was adopted by white people, but that is his, you know, that's what his blackness looks like and that's what it feels like. And, you know, and it doesn't, and in no way, his being raised by white people, no way detracts from his ability to speak up for people that look like him, you know. And it's not that we're all the same, but that said, you know, people are going to look at him and try to, you know, put him in a box and limit his experiences. When we're talking about, like, sort of that blackness scale in my story, what I'm really talking about is this sort of stereotypes assigned to being in a certain type of body. And, you know, there's so much that comes with that. But really, all of them are sort of limiting. All of them are sort of reductive. All of them sort of flatten you out. And so I think, you know, when Harrison says that he's really doing that same kind of work of flattening this human being who is, you know, full of all this potential into, like, you know, trying to put him in a very neat box. And, you know, humans aren't, you know, I don't think so easily categorized that way.
I've heard you describe in other interviews the concept of the white default character in literature, that unless readers are explicitly told that a character is not white, we assume that he or she must be white.
Right.
How do you try to subvert that? I noticed that you're not so explicit.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's hopefully changing because it's an annoying thing to have to, like, negotiate that, you know, we're so used to having these white protagonists that you have to do a lot of work to make it so that isn't the case. But I know I just sort of try to have so one thing I might do is like have a story go on and then you don't find out that they're explicitly black till way later on to the story. And then again, I just sort of retrain your mind, you know, our minds as readers to not just default to anything, you know.
But you're doing it with context clues, right? Like mm-hmm. we learn things about your character and then you piece it together and realize, oh, okay. And
right.
then maybe it's a check on yourself as a reader, like, oh, I assumed this person was white until I was told otherwise.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then in my stories, you know, I'm pretty much in the place where I think you should assume they're black until I tell you otherwise. Mm. You know, as again, and that's very specifically sort of considering that that's very rarely the case.
So what role do you think that fiction can play in helping readers empathize with the real life struggles of people they encounter? I mean, can you actually affect social change in that way?
I absolutely believe you can. I think reading fiction is like sort of an inherently an empathetic gesture to allow someone else to enter that sort of sacred space of your mind and speak and like have, you know, and have them speak in their voice and, you know, sort of. There's sort of a mind meld that happens every time you do that and to follow their world, a world that they created, you know, and really try to meet them there. You know, every time a reader reads my work, I feel like, you know, I take it's an honor for me because that's an important gesture to like literally step into someone else's shoes or even a soul, if you want to call it that, for whatever time you're reading this thing and see what's to be seen, you know, on it, like take an earnest journey into someone else's sort of way of looking into the world and understand, oh, like you said, like, you might have the thing like, oh, wait, why did I default to that? That might happen. And so many other different types of magic might happen. And I think generally with fiction, though, it's nice to you have an opportunity to stretch your imagination out. And I think that for sure can affect social change because I think so much social change is, you know, so much of it is in sort of growing your capacity to imagine a better world.
I want to ask a little bit about the success of this book. It came out in October and has received a lot of praise since then. You were named one of the 5 under 35 authors for 2018 by the National Book Foundation. The book won a 2019 Penn Gene Stein Book Award. It's shortlisted for the 2019 Dylan Thomas Prize. I mean, what is it like to experience all this success all of a sudden?
It's a lot, you know. I get to be on the radio all the time.
Seth Meyers?
I did Seth Meyers, you know, which is cool. Got a whole bunch of free, like, you know, Seth Meyers swag. I got a mug that I broke.
I'm sure he would send you another one.
I wonder if he will. You think so?
Yeah, just ask. Seth, if you're listening, Nana could use another mug.
I could use another one or like three. And it's been a huge blessing, and I don't take it for granted because, you know, I it's not so long ago that the people that read my work were just pretty much me and my Facebook friends, you know, and, you know, to be anywhere in the world and have someone say my work affected them, you know, it's really huge. And so that's the bigger thing. The accolades and the awards, I mean, don't get me wrong, I like those. Like, and please, like, I'll take them. I don't want to take myself out of the running for any of those things. Please give me the award. But it isn't the biggest.
It is campaign season, so yeah.
It isn't the biggest thing. The cooler thing for me is just that any person might, you know, feel a little more seen, feel like they saw themselves in the work, or maybe just feel like, you know, they liked it. You know, to me, that's important. And the awards are sort of gravy on top of that.
Last thing I'm wondering about is a lot of your books are very critical of our culture. Are you actually hopeful, or are you as sort of cynical as perhaps the commentary would lead us to believe?
You know, I'm very cynical, but I also do have hope. And to me, and as I've kind of spoke about the book more and more, I'm starting to realize that they're connected to each other. And that is, to me, like, I think hope without honesty is like a lie. You know, I think you have to be really honest about the world we live in. I think you have to sometimes be pretty cynical. And I think that hope without that honesty, that sort of thoughts and prayers, that means nothing. So I hope that, I know that I'm hopeful, and, you know, I just think we have a lot of work to do.
Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya is the author of Friday Black. He'll be reading from his book tonight at Porter Square Books. And there's more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. Nana, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow, or Monday, rather, for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.